Welcome to History Counts. History provides the roadmap to the future. If you want to know where you're going, you have to understand where you've been. I'm your host, Ken McDermott-Rowe. China, the rising superpower, is destined to play a major role in future global affairs, and its policies will have a great effect on the West, especially on the United States. While Chinese policy towards the West will be formed in large part by China's immediate strategic and economic self-interest, China's policies will also be influenced by its past experiences with Western powers. In today's edition of History Counts, we'll closely examine a very important chapter in Sino-Western relations, known as the Opium Wars. These two wars, which took place in the 19th century, were waged by Britain against China to compel China to permit the importation of opium, a highly addictive drug from which heroin was later derived. How did opium come to be imported to China? Who profited from the trade? What were the effects on the Chinese people? And what are the implications for the future relations between China and the West? To learn the answers, please stay tuned for the next edition of History Counts, The Opium Wars, How the West Hooked China. Welcome back to History Counts. This is your host, Ken McDermott-Rowe. The rise of China as a world power is among the most important historical developments of the last few decades. How China deals with the outside world, in particular the United States and Europe, will likely be affected by its past experiences with foreigners. So in today's program, we take a look at an extremely important episode in Chinese-Western relations, which became known as the Opium Wars. To help us understand the events of this period, we're very fortunate to have with us Frank Sinello, author of The Opium Wars, The Addiction of One Empire and the Corruption of Another. It was published by Sourcebooks and has been translated into both Mandarin and Cantonese. Mr. Sinello is also the author of The Knights Templars, God's Warriors, The Devil's Bankers, published in 2003. Mr. Sinello, thanks very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for asking me. I appreciate it.
When and where were the Opium Wars, and who were the antagonists?
They took place in the 19th century. They were two wars fought between Britain and China, both on Chinese territory. The first war was between 1839 and 1842, and the second war was between 1856 and 1860. The primary cause of both wars was China's tragically unsuccessful attempts to stop the British from importing opium from British-controlled India into China. In the late 19th century, opium was turned into heroin and morphine, although opium is not nearly as addictive as heroin and morphine, whose active ingredients are more concentrated.
How did the British decision to import opium into China in the 19th century relate to Britain's trade deficits, and in particular to tea?
In 1674, King Charles II of England got a gift of 2 pounds of strange-smelling black leaves, which turned out to be tea. Within 20 years, England was drinking gallons and gallons and gallons of it, and the Chinese insisted on payment in silver. They would not trade British manufactured goods in exchange for tea. Finally, the British came up with something the Chinese were willing to trade besides silver for tea, and that was opium, because as any junkie will tell you, it's a seller's market.
So the opium, as I understand it, was grown by the East India Company, British monopoly, in India, and then imported at that time through Canton into China?
Correct.
Now, there was an important cultural conflict that also comes into play in the British-Chinese relations. Could you talk about the unsuccessful 1793 trade mission of Lord Macartney, and particularly reference to the practice of kowtowing? What is kowtowing, and how did that come up in the course of Lord Macartney's mission?
Kowtowing, in the generic meaning, is bowing, but in China, it included when you met the emperor, you had to bow, genuflect, and then put your forehead on the ground 9 times.
So this struck Lord McCartney and the British the wrong way.
Right. He was willing to do it because Britain was so desperate to open up more ports to trade with China. But, and this is where the farcical elements come in, he brought along with him a giant oil painting of King George III, and he said to the courtiers, I will kowtow, I'll even put my forehead on the marble floor 9 times if the courtiers do the same to the painting of King George III. And, of course, the Chinese courtiers said, you're nuts. And at that, the emperor dismissed him, and McCartney departed China after spending £80,000.
You also mentioned that the presents that he brought for the Chinese emperor were referred to by the Chinese as, quote, tribute from the Red Barbarians.
McCartney considered them gifts, and the emperor didn't recognize any other monarchs. He was the only ruler in the world, and a non-monarch doesn't give gifts to a monarch. He pays tribute. Plus, when McCartney said, well, we've got all these great manufactured goods for you, like calico and other textiles and farm equipment that we'll trade you for tea, the emperor incorrectly said, there's nothing Britain has that we can't make ourselves, which was not true, as the later battles proved, because the Chinese had 200-year-old weapons against Britain's state-of-the-art weapons.
The opium that came from India, from the East India Company, was sold by private merchants, chiefly British and some Americans and others, through Canton with the cooperation of some Chinese merchants called the Kohong?
Yes, they were the intermediaries.
And this was a very profitable trade for the British and American merchants?
Incredible. The British Exchequer, which is our counterpart of the Treasury Department and the IRS, was addicted to the revenues produced by the tax on opium because they slapped 100% tax on all the money the British made from selling opium. But the British merchants still made out like bandits because they put a 400% markup on the cost of actually producing or growing the opium. So everybody made money except the Chinese.
How pervasive was opium addiction in China in the early 19th century?
This is a shocking statistic. 90%, it's estimated, of the emperor's court and 90% of his military, including his generals, were users of opium. And at the time of the first opium war in 1832, it was estimated that 14 million Chinese were full-blown addicts. It devastated Chinese society much the same way, only worse than the crack epidemic did in the inner city here in the 80s and 90s, and what methamphetamine, crystal meth, is doing to the U.S. today. Society collapsed. People stopped working. China was a country of scholars. All the government officials, in order to get promoted, the way they got promoted was taking Chinese literature tests. They didn't take, bureaucrat tests. And it was a major scandal that all these students were dropping out of school because they were stoned out of their mind on a heroin substitute.
You cite a French study that found that a person lived only about 6 years after becoming an opium addict.
Opium does do major damage to your internal organs, and it eventually blows up your liver.
Was opium illegal in Britain at that time?
No. It was allowed. The reason the British weren't nearly so affected is that it was sold in a form called laudanum, which was red wine with just a teeny little bit of opium in it, but it was enough to get people addicted anyway, but not nearly as bad as smoking it. One of the few British politicians who opposed the opium trade was the future Prime Minister William Gladstone, because his poor sister got addicted to laudanum, liquid opium, and she died of it.
Well, could you talk about the efforts made by China, in particular China's High Commissioner Lin, in 1839 to suppress opium use and trafficking?
Commissioner Lin was one of the few incorruptible officials in China, and the emperor sent him to Canton to tell the British to stop importing opium, and they ignored him because they were making a 400% profit. And so Lyndon did the equivalent of America's Boston Tea Party, and he had Chinese board British ships that had opium, and they threw the opium overboard just the way the American colonials overthrew British tea overboard because they didn't like the competition. And he also burned a lot of it. And the way the British reacted was by invading the country twice.
You describe the two wars as a single war with a 14-year intermission, and you also say that it was essentially a war of the medieval versus the modern. In what sense was it the medieval versus the modern?
Britain at the time was the only superpower in the world. The United States was not yet a superpower. And China, despite its incredible history of innovations, they invented 500 years or more before us, paper currency, coal for burning, I could go on and on and on, history writing, among other things. But technologically, they were very backward, and they were using 200-year-old weapons, including bows and arrows, against Britain, which had a precursor of the machine gun called Armstrong rockets, which, instead of shooting bullets, shot a zillion arrows at a time. And also, the Second Opium War was the first time that steamships were introduced in battle 10 years before the Civil War, the battle between the Monitor and the Merrimack. And against these steamships, the Chinese used the aptly named junks, which were powered by sail, and they didn't stand a chance. The strangest, and again, this is farcical if it weren't tragic, is that all along the waterways in China, there were forts with cannons, and the cannons were bolted to the fort, and they couldn't raise or lower the barrel of the cannons. And so as the British warships sailed by or steamed by, the Chinese would fire the cannons, but since they couldn't aim them, the cannonballs went over the top of the masts of the ship. And they were so ineffective that one of the commanders sat on the deck sunning himself while the Chinese cannons fired over the heads of the masts.
So the battles were very lopsided.
Right. Sounds like a Cheech and Chong costume epic, but the Chinese were so stoned out of their minds that during some battles, the British suffered not a single casualty. Can you imagine a battle where nobody died on one side?
So the First Opium War ends in a truce, then fighting resumes, and then there is a treaty in 1858. It's Tianjin.
Right.
What are the terms that the Chinese finally have to come to with the British?
They had to surrender the Kowloon Peninsula, which includes Hong Kong, and they also had to open up about 5 additional ports.
As I understand it, the trade was really getting bottlenecked in Canton, so the
right.
opening of more ports became a key issue.
And one of the other issues, which was less important, but they had been demanding it since 1793 when McCartney went there, was the permission to open an embassy in the capital, Peking, which is Beijing today. And finally, in 1858, the Chinese agreed. However, they didn't agree to the official legalization of opium, and the British slipped it in by saying, we are going to let you tax at 5% the following products. And they listed harmless stuff like brocades and calico and, you know, manufacture agricultural equipment and, by the way, opium. And that's how they continued to import opium despite the legal ban.
So it was de facto legalization, even though it was a fiction that it was still a contraband. But the 1858 treaty didn't end the war. Continues for a while, continues to the gates of Peking. Can you talk about the violent end?
Right. 2 years later, in 1860, they had to sign another treaty called the Treaty or Convention of Peking, because in 1858, the emperor's courtiers signed the treaty, but the emperor refused. So the British reinvaded, or actually they just continued to invade, and they forced the emperor personally to sign the treaty, which was an incredible humiliation because his title was Son of Heaven. He was considered a god like the Japanese emperor. And to make him sign anything was just like, you know, making the Pope today fill out the IRS form. And the reason the British were so angry by 1860 at the time of the second treaty was that between the two treaties, the British sent some emissaries under flag of truce. The emperor had them imprisoned and tortured and mutilated. And in retaliation, despite the fact that the Chinese were really nasty, in retaliation, Lord Elgin, who was a Scottish earl, who was the British plenipotentiary or ambassador at the time to China, he didn't blame the Chinese people. He wanted to personally punish the emperor for torturing and killing the British POWs. He ordered the burning of the emperor's summer palace on the outskirts of Peking. And it wasn't comparable to the loss of the two burnings of the Library of Alexandria, which contained all the knowledge of ancient Greece, but it was certainly more of a loss than the burning of Windsor Castle in, what, 1992 or 3, because the Summer Palace, besides its magnificent architecture, its contents were even more valuable, and it included priceless, irreplaceable manuscripts, art, sculpture, the history of China, everything, and they burned it to the ground.
I was astounded to see it was 80 square miles.
Yes,
a huge place.
And it was beautifully landscaped. But even more important than the property was the contents. I mean, it was like burning down the Library of Congress, plus the Smithsonian, plus the New York Metropolitan Art Museum.
Well, now, you mentioned that some British leaders, like Gladstone, opposed the opium trade. You write that the leaders of the Anglican Church were opposed to the opium trade. Mm-hmm. Some of even the high officials, like Charles Eliot, the superintendent of trade, were opposed to the opium trade. Why weren't these people successful in getting Britain to put a stop to the opium trade in China?
For the same reason we still don't have universal, free, affordable health care. The opium lobby was incredibly powerful because the opium merchants were very rich and they could afford to pay the very best lobbyists, and the lobbyists dominated Parliament.
Who were William Jardine and James Matheson?
The East India Company had a monopoly on the opium trade until 1832, when the monopoly was removed because the East India Company was corrupt, plus everybody else wanted to get into the business. And once they lost their monopoly, the vacuum was filled by everybody who was a merchant in Britain, and the most successful was the firm of Jardine, Matheson, and Company.
And they became very famous in Hong Kong as a trading firm as well, didn't they?
Yes, they were the Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, and Donald Trump rolled into one of the day.
You quote a press release from Jardine Matheson, which says, quote, "Opium is not a curse, but a comfort and a benefit to the hardworking Chinese," close quote.
What can I say? It's the same drug companies that push drugs that turn out to cause heart attacks.
Well, now the British won the war. They get de facto legalization of the opium trade in China. What happens to opium imports to China in the years following 1860?
It only got worse because originally opium could only be grown in India because of the climate. By the end of the 19th century, the Chinese figured out how to grow it locally, which meant it was cheaper and therefore more plentiful.
You quote that in the 20 years following the war, that the imports actually doubled. You give a figure of 105,000 chests of opium. I think that's, you say, 170 pounds per chest. And I did
Correct.
Some quick calculations. 18 million pounds of opium. It's a heck of a lot of opium.
Right.
And that would be in 1 year in 1879. So this solved both the sterling trade deficit problem, and it also solved a big hole in the British budget by providing them with an extraordinary amount of revenues.
Right. Before they started importing opium into China, the British Treasury was paying for tea 39,000 pounds, and the Chinese were only paying 7,000 pounds. And before they started selling opium, the British were literally going broke, and they were desperate. And they finally, as I said, found something besides silver, which the Chinese were willing to pay for in return for tea. Another problem was that the Chinese not only would only accept silver, but they would only accept silver Spanish dollars, which were the American dollars of the era. And because of wars between Spain and Britain, Britain didn't have access to Spanish dollars. So even if they had wanted to pay for the tea with silver, they couldn't while the wars were going on. One was the American Revolution, and the other was the Napoleonic Wars, in which Spain was allied with France.
The legacy of the Opium Wars goes on in the 20th century, and you're right that in the 1920s and 30s, Chiang Kai-shek was financing his army with opium taxes. This is a general supported by the United States in his struggle with the communists.
Well, what can I say? During the Vietnam War, this is a well-known fact, the CIA imported heroin into Southeast Asia to finance the war as well, but even worse, during World War II, after the Japanese occupied a huge portion of China, they were passing out free heroin because an intoxicated population was a docile population. So as if the Chinese didn't have enough problems with opium, they were also being poisoned by the Japanese with an even more addictive drug, heroin.
In the aftermath of World War II, Mao and the communists come to power in China. What does he do about the opium addiction problem in 1949?
Okay, far from it, for me to be an apologist for a genocidal tyrant like Mao. He was in one way way ahead of his time and shared the current enlightened attitude in America that says rehabilitation rather than incarceration for drug offenders. And within 10 years of Mao coming to power, he eradicated opium. And the way he did that was by summarily executing opium dealers. No nothing. He just executed them. However, the reason he was enlightened was opium addicts who weren't selling the stuff were sent to rehabilitation facilities, but they were only given one chance. And if they relapsed, they were sent to quote-unquote re-education camps where part of the curriculum was starvation.
Well, we talked about the economic incentive, the vast profits in opium, and we talked about the cultural differences between China and Britain. Do you think if the cultural differences had been overcome, that the two countries could have come to some kind of a resolution, a peaceful resolution, which would have kept opium out? Or do you think that opium was just too profitable to forego?
The cultural differences were mostly matters of protocol. There were major political differences. China was an autocracy, and of course the U.S. is a democracy, but the real reason was money was the root of everything. It was the bottom line.
To what extent do you think that Chinese attitudes today towards the West, or the United States in particular, are affected by China's experience in the Opium Wars?
Let me speak about 1997, which is when the 100-year lease, the British lease of Hong Kong, which they got after the Treaty of 1860 in Peking, ended, and the British honored it and sailed away. Hong Kong at the time was the bastion of capitalism in Asia, and the people were terrified that the Chinese government, to which Hong Kong reverted, would confiscate private property. And yet, despite that fear, and also that the rich would be put into concentration camps the way they were when Mao took over China in 1949. Despite all those fears, when Prince Charles sailed away, he showed up for the farewell ceremony. The Hong Kong people had massive celebrations because they still hated British imperialists. And their fears, as you know, turned out to be groundless for one simple reason, and the reason Communist China didn't impose socialism on Hong Kong was that the biggest investors in Hong Kong property, building and real estate, was China. They invested billions of dollars in Hong Kong, and if they had confiscated everything, the property would have become worthless. And that's why Hong Kong, except for having some political limits, and they don't have an elected parliament or Congress, that's why Hong Kong remains capitalist, because the Chinese communists would have lost a bundle if they had imposed socialism on Hong Kong.
Talking about the impact of the importation of opium into China, you made an analogy in your book to the Mexican and Colombian drug cartels in the Western Hemisphere. Could you expand on that and describe what similarities you see?
Sure. Consider this scenario, which even the most outrageous science fiction writer would never try to pull off. Imagine if the Colombian and Mexican cartels somehow got hold of an atom bomb and bombed about 10 American cities, and the Americans gave up and surrendered, and in return, the Colombians and the Mexican drug narco-traffickers that we want to have total legal and political control over the following five major cities. We don't want to pay taxes. We don't want to have any interference. And Americans are not allowed in this city without our permission. Plus, you have to pay us $5 million, which is what the British demanded in reparations as part of the terms of the Treaty of 1860. And as crazy as that sounds, that's exactly what happened after the Second Opium War.
Mr. Cinello, thanks very much for being with us today. You're listening to History Counts. We've been speaking with Frank Cinello, author of The Opium Wars, The Addiction of One Empire and the Corruption of Another. It's about how Britain compelled China to accept the importation of opium. This is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'll be right back. While Britain, the leading military power of the day, carried out the Opium Wars, it was not just British merchants who benefited from the lucrative opium trade. As we now know from the research of Professors Jacques Downs and Elizabeth Gray, American merchants also played a significant role in the importation of opium into China. American merchants began importing opium into China as early as the 1790s, while the British obtained their opium from India. The American merchants obtained the drug from Turkey, loaded it on their ships at Smyrna for the trip to China. Among the many American merchants participating in the opium trade in the 19th century was Stephen Girard of Philadelphia. In 1805, Girard wrote to two of his supercargo ships in the Mediterranean, quote, "I am very much in favor of investing heavily in opium." The enormous profitability in the opium trade is evidenced by the fact that when Stephen Girard died in 1831, he was and had been for 20 years the richest man in America. American opium merchants like Girard were not shadowy figures operating at the margins of society. Indeed, opium traders were prominent members of the business community and included many famous families such as the Peabodys of Massachusetts and the Astors and Delanos of New York. Opium merchant Warren Delano was grandfather of President Franklin Roosevelt. In 1839, Delano offered his support for Britain's invasion of China. Britain, he said, should, quote, "knock a little reason into the bigoted people." However, the American opium trade was not without its ironies. As Professor Gray has shown, not all the profits went into the pockets of the merchants. Indeed, many important charitable and educational institutions in America received large sums of money from opium merchants. A leading opium merchant, Thomas Perkins of Boston, became a huge philanthropist and endowed an institution to help the blind. And John C. Green, whose firm Russell & Co. dominated the opium trade by the mid-1830s, was in the 19th century the largest benefactor of Princeton University. History Counts is produced by MDR Productions, Inc., B.J. McDermott Rowe, Technical Director. Please visit us at historycounts.org, where you can listen for free to an archive of our programs, see a schedule of upcoming shows, and sign up for our monthly newsletter. Until next time, this is Ken McDermott Rowe for History Counts.